B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Tuesday, May 2nd, 2019. The stone wall the White House is erecting between its end of Pennsylvania Avenue and the U.S. Capitol is getting a little higher. Today, Attorney General Bill Barr was a no-show. He had been asked to appear at the House Judiciary Committee by Chairman Gerald Nadler, and he didn't show up because he didn't want to adopt the format that Nadler was offering. And that is, there'd be a round of questions by members and then 2 half-hour sessions with lawyers, one for the Democrats and one for the Republicans. And this process has been used routinely in the past, but Bill Barr decided that it's not suitable for him. So this increases the tensions and the conflict between the Trump administration and the Democratic leaders, in particular, in the House of Representatives. And this follows yesterday's contentious hearing. And it was fascinating. It went on too long, and I didn't have enough time to capture and watch it all. But the segments I heard were these alternate, blistering interrogations of 5 minutes by Democratic senators, followed by 5 minutes of softballs pitched by Republicans. Now, this is pretty much the pattern. That's not that surprising. But the Republicans continue to press for an investigation of the Mueller investigation. And as you know, because I have issues with Mueller, I have issues with his claim of a sweeping and systematic effort that by Russia to interfere in the 2016 election. But I do agree with the obstruction of justice claims that were presented in the Mueller report. And what we saw was a very skillful liar named Bill Barr, who dodged the tough questions from the Democrats and took the love from the Republicans. And they are on very, very different tracks. Now, one of the surprise rounds was when Senator Mazie Hirono of Hawaii delivered a very, very strong comment to William P. Barr. And she basically said he had lied to Congress and that, like Kellyanne Conway and Rudy Giuliani, that he had risked his own reputation for what she called the liar and grifter who occupies the Oval Office. It was pretty stunning. Kamala Harris of California, she's running for president. She did a kind of what's become her routine, a lot of yes or no questions, very aggressive follow-ups, and pressing for an answer as the clock runs. And there were other moments, too. Dick Durbin, Sheldon Whitehouse, they all conducted some tough questioning of the attorney general. And fundamentally, it appears that Bill Barr has lied to Congress. And the issue is confirmed by the letter that Robert Mueller wrote to the attorney general taking issue with Barr's failure to publish the executive summaries that Mueller and his team had written so that they could be released on the day that he turned in his report to the Justice Department. As you know, it was almost, I think, 18 days before Barr finally released the redacted version of Bob Mueller's report. But in between that time, he testified before two committees, one Senate and one House, and he was asked if Robert Mueller had objected to the way that Barr was slow rolling the rollout of the Mueller report. And in both cases, while he was under oath, Bill Barr said no. Now, this is a clear case of perjury. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said what is deadly serious is the Attorney General of the U.S. was not telling the truth to the Congress of the United States. That's a crime. And so what are the Democrats going to do about it? Nancy Pelosi keeps an arm's length distance from calls for impeachment. There have been some kind of reactionary calls to impeach Bill Barr. Maybe that would warm up the Congress and the nation to an impeachment for Trump. I'm certainly not opposed to it. But the Democrats are getting caught between their angry and very strong rhetoric and the inaction on the remedy that the Constitution provides for a criminal president or a criminal attorney general. Now, they could vote to hold Bill Barr in contempt of Congress. But you probably have forgotten that Republicans did that when they held the majority back in 2012, and they issued a contempt of Congress vote against Attorney General Eric Holder. I believe that was related to the Fast and Furious case. And in that matter, I didn't support Eric Holder. He was stonewalling. So it's fair to say that the Democrats have an axe they can grind, an axe that they can swing, an axe they can wield. But what remains to be seen is if they actually will wield it. So we have Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand, all Democratic senators, all running for president, all calling for Bill Barr to resign. And so did Mazie Hirono. She says, you lied to Congress. You knew. You lied. And now we know. And Barr was performing very well as the president's attorney and not as the attorney general of the United States. And he broke down, for example, the incidents where Trump, and this is outlined in the Mueller report, that Trump ordered his White House counsel, Don McGahn, to tell Rod Rosenstein at the Justice Department to fire Mueller because of a phony conflict of interest. And so Barr breaks this down by saying, number one, that the Mueller report shows that Trump had been falsely accused of collusion with Russia. That is narrowly true. But Barr then tries to twist that into saying that since that's the case, he couldn't possibly have obstructed justice because he has the right to fire Bob Mueller or the FBI director Jim Comey. And Barr found that because the president argues that he was falsely accused, that there is no underlying crime and therefore there couldn't be obstruction of justice. But even though I don't buy the Russian collusion argument, never did, Trump has been running a cover-up since the Mike Flynn incident, which happened on day three or day four of his presidency. And regardless of the presence or lack of an underlying crime, Trump is vulnerable to charges of obstruction of justice. And so he found the best lawyer, the Roy Cohn he was looking for. And Bill Barr has sullied his reputation. But I don't think he cares. He's a movement Republican, a former CIA employee, a guy who was the fixer for George H.W. Bush. And he revels in this role. His arrogance is at a peak when he is in combat mode before Congress. And so, as we saw this play out yesterday, Barr probably resonates with many Republicans who support Trump. But Dick Durbin, the senator from Illinois, his comment that Barr was trying to stage a complicated kabuki dance, I think that's quite fair. And today, my San Francisco Chronicle says William Barr should resign. And I agree with that. But it requires honor and or a sense of shame. And I don't think that Mr. Barr possesses either one. So last night, Hillary Clinton was scheduled to appear on Rachel Maddow's program. And it appeared to me they were going to give her the full hour, but they had to cover the bar combat event on Capitol Hill. And Hillary Clinton offered a lot of comments. Maybe you saw it. But what really struck me is when she said that Russia succeeded. And I want you to listen to her words, because she didn't explicitly say that I would be president except for Vladimir Putin's scheme to elect Trump. Those are my words, but listen to hers and see how she explains it.
I learned more, and I learned more detail.
Okay.
But here's the important thing to me. What I learned is that the Russians were successful. I don't think there's any way to read that report and not conclude they accomplished what they set out to do. They had an objective to sow discord and divisiveness within our society at large, and to help Donald Trump, and they succeeded.
And this just shows the sense of entitlement and just how out of touch Hillary Rodham Clinton is. She cannot understand how weak a candidate she was, that her emails were a self-inflicted wound. They never would have been weaponized if she hadn't tried to keep them from the reach of the Freedom of Information Act. But that's all lost in this, because she was entitled to be the next president. Many of her supporters believe that the email scandal was nothing. It was an error that could have been avoided. But she's dug in, and Russia is the easy way to explain her stunning loss in 2016. She continues.
So let's move our vision forward and say to yourself, if you're in the Kremlin, you're Vladimir Putin, who I've sat across, I understand his goal is to weaken America. I know that. He doesn't like me because I stood up for America. I get it. So if you're sitting there and you're saying, this worked really well, Trump just foments divisiveness in America. He's helping to tear the country apart.
Now, here, she actually acknowledges the divisiveness of Trump. And the effort of Russia to sow discord in this country, that is such a joke compared to the way Trump has succeeded in dividing us even further. I mean, we were pretty divided before he showed up on the scene.
People are so upset. What are we going to do to help him this time? How do we best accomplish that? And because we have no real follow-up, and one of the things that concerned me in the Mueller report is when it's written that they didn't investigate whether or not the Russian active measures actually changed votes or affected the outcome, because they assumed someone else was doing that.
Mm-hmm.
They assumed the FBI was doing that. And then we learn that the former Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security is ordered not to talk about election interference in front of Trump. And then we learn that there is no concerted effort going on anywhere in our government to try to understand what it means that, for example, at least one county in Florida was breached. But not only that, the network of election machinery in one area. What does all that mean?
And she's fumbling there. She's talking about an intrusion into the website of a company that makes election hardware. And do you notice? She doesn't make a single mention of the sweeping Republican efforts to suppress Democratic votes in 2016. And she wants to talk about a breach in Florida of a county voting registrar's website, where we're told no votes were changed. But she's never spoken up about the claim that 75,000 votes were not counted in Detroit and Flint, Michigan, enabling Trump to carry that state by less than 11,000 votes. And so this obsession with Russia is such a convenient dodge. And Hillary Clinton, I think in full arrogance mode, was serving it up big time, and Rachel Maddow was lapping it up like usual. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the PBC Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Peter Hoffmeister, Janet Price, Polina Vasilev, and Scott Bigelow. They each make a contribution, and you can do it too. All you have to do is visit peterbcollins.com, click on the menu tab, click on Become a Subscriber. You'll hit the sign-up page where it's easy to choose a level of support that's comfortable for you. And if you don't want a PayPal subscription, you can communicate with me at my post office box, number 150-660, San Rafael, zip code 94915. That's box 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. So today's New York Times has the latest salvo in information warfare being waged against the legitimate government of Venezuela, led by its embattled president, Nicolas Maduro. And the New York Times has accessed a secret dossier. You ever heard that word before? Compiled by Venezuelan agents. And they are focused on an advisor to Maduro who serves in the cabinet. He's the interior minister. And I think he's a former vice president, maybe. Anyway, his name is Tarek El Aissami. He is of Syrian heritage. And the allegation is that El Aissami and his family have helped sneak Hezbollah militants into the country. They've gone into business with a drug lord. They've shielded 140 tons of chemicals believed to be used for cocaine production, helping make him a rich man as his country has spiraled into disarray. Does this smell like political propaganda to you? It does to me, and it looks like yellow journalism, too. And I am not in a position to evaluate who's honorable and who's corrupt in Venezuela. I don't doubt that there is significant corruption. But this is just an out-of-left-field hit. And it is time to support the cheerleading effort by the U.S. media and virtually all of our politicians. And we led the podcast with this yesterday. The corporate media has not allowed a single critical voice to be heard, challenging the U.S. regime change operation in Venezuela. And here's the Washington Post forced to shift out of cheerleading mode because, well, it's not going so well. Venezuela's opposition sought to maintain pressure Thursday on Maduro through further protests following a failed attempt to stage a peaceful military revolt Tuesday and overthrow Maduro. The opposition was facing limited options. Juan Guaido called on Venezuelans to stage daily protests until Maduro leaves. After 2 days of violent protests that left 4 people dead and dozens wounded, the opposition was banking on a resilient populace to continue the effort, though it remained unclear how exhausted, crisis-battered Venezuelans would respond. So this is interesting. It's a challenge because the media thought this would be a cakewalk. They don't air out any political opposition to this domestically. And they imagine that this is just an all-American regime change program that we can all get behind. And in the second last paragraph of a story that prints out 4 pages, 8.5 by 11, we get this. Maduro claimed victory in an election last year in which key opposition candidates were barred from running. That's not true. Key opposition candidates boycotted that election. The article continues, the result was decried internationally as fraudulent. Not until it became the convenient rationale for regime change. Now, I'm noticing a little shift in tone at The Guardian. I look at their news website every day, and as I've mentioned, I like some of the enterprise reporting they do here in the United States. I don't trust them so much on some of their foreign coverage. And what I've noticed is that they are getting more even-handed. It's not like they're, you know, backing down from generalized support of Maduro. But in an article showing that the president thanked his military for resisting what he called a treacherous imperial plot to topple him, quote, loyalty is a value you either have or you don't. I know you will not fail the homeland, he told troops in Caracas yesterday. And about halfway through the article, The Guardian actually prints the voices of people who support Maduro. Here's one, 40-year-old Raiza Castillo, captured at a pro-Maduro march winding through central Caracas on May Day. She was scornful of the opposition's chances. They're out of touch with reality, she said, and we know that if they get into power, the first thing they'll do is get rid of all the benefits and improvements that we have won under Chavez and Maduro. Then they quote the head of communications for Maduro's PSUV party. For 20 years, the extreme right has tried to take power by force and not through democracy. What we saw yesterday followed the same pattern of hybrid warfare, terrorist actions with a few figureheads out in front, in this case Guaido and his political mentor, Leopoldo López. Now, the rest of the article is pretty pro-Guaido, but there is a sense of balance there, and that's a little bit of progress. Also, people I know, Kevin Zeese and Medea Benjamin. Kevin is the leader of Popular Resistance, and Medea, Code Pink. They are continuing their occupation of the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. It's a friendly occupation, which is supported by the Maduro government. And Kevin Zeese, interviewed in a piece published at Consortium News today, says, we have upwards of 50 people living here. We began on April 10th. It's ongoing. We work. We sleep here. We cook here. This has become our home. We see ourselves as tenants of the Venezuelan government. We live here with the permission of the elected government. There was no unlawful entry, no trespass. We see ourselves as interim protectors because the U.S. Embassy in Caracas is vacant and the U.S. wants to have Switzerland serve as a protectorate for that embassy. Venezuela is negotiating with other countries to be a protectorate for this embassy. Well, tomorrow I am participating in a rally here in San Francisco in support of press freedom and Julian Assange. And last night, I posted an announcement on Facebook that reads just that. I wrote, Rally for Assange and Press Freedom, Friday, May 3rd, 4 p.m., and we'll be gathering at the British Consulate at No. 1 Sansom Street here in San Francisco. So it was up for about 15 minutes before my former radio colleague, Christine Kraft, posted five words. Party for double rapists, ... never. And I find this offensive. I've known Christine for over 20 years, and sometimes I've agreed with her, sometimes I've disagreed with her. But she's trained in the law, and she knows, or should know, that Julian Assange has never been accused of rape. The sex charges in Sweden related to two different consensual encounters with women. And I wrote back to Christine, it's disappointing you choose to focus on Assange's obvious personal defects instead of the effort to crush the sources of critical investigative reporting. Assange isn't American, never operated in the United States. The charge he faces is trivial and a clear pretext for a crackdown on leakers. I stand against excessive government secrecy, including cover-ups of likely crimes. Do you? And let's see who else replied here. My friend Chris Clark. He used to be a talk show host at KGO here in San Francisco. And he notes, he just says, nope, he's not a journalist. There's ample evidence to that fact. More than has been revealed publicly. The reality of what he really is frightening and a threat to a democracy that is already under fire. And Chris references, he said, perhaps you remember my family's background. His father was a British spy for MI6. And therefore, he hints, the sources I'm privy to. He's a bad dude, and I repeat, not a journalist. So I responded to Chris, I understand your view, and you can define journalism as you wish. While Assange is made out to be the Johnny Rotten of journalism, WikiLeaks perform functions that are integral to investigative reporting, and that's what I think is at stake here. Perhaps you should know that I have a pretty good memory and know your family business. My bias is that excessive secrecy and criminal cover-ups are a real threat to democracy, and WikiLeaks and Ed Snowden have made important revelations that have proven to be accurate, if unpopular. And this morning, Chris replied, with all due respect, I disagree completely with every point you made. So these are people who claim to be progressives. And so I hope that those of you within the sound of my voice and close enough to get to San Francisco on Friday afternoon will join us at the British Consulate at 4 p.m. And in Britain today, Julian Assange made a video appearance in a courtroom. It was brief. And he was asked if he wished to consent to surrender himself for extradition to the United States. And Assange said, "I do not wish to surrender myself for extradition for doing journalism that's won many, many awards and affected many people. And the process here is likely to be lengthy, months, if not years. One of the deadlines upcoming is that the U.S. has to submit a final list of the charges against Assange before Britain agrees to extradition. And of course, they won't extradite if the death penalty is available. And there are a few other issues that will have to be hashed out, too. You can find a good article about the court appearance by Joe Lauria at Consortium News today. And this, as I said, is going to be a lengthy process, and we will continue to follow it here. But I hope you will be able to join us tomorrow afternoon in San Francisco, and we will make our statement on behalf of freedom of the press. There are now 21 Democrats, 7 senators, running for the Democratic nomination for the 2020 presidential race. The latest is Michael Bennett, a moderate Democratic senator from Colorado, and his former boss. He was the chief of staff to John Hickenlooper when he was governor of Colorado. And I'm not really sure why Michael Bennett is running for president. He recently survived prostate cancer. And while he says that climate change is one of his top issues, he supports the Keystone XL pipeline. He's another moderate that I think would just be chewed up in a race against Trump. And, of course, the front-runner moderate, at least this week, is Joe Biden, the former vice president and longtime senator. And I want to thank Aldous Tyler from Madison, Wisconsin, who posted a note showing that a recent poll that was published showing that Joe Biden is far out in front didn't include any respondents under the age of 50. I think that's only one poll. I haven't really had a chance to study the landscape there. But yesterday, I got an email from Alyssa Milano. You know, the actress. She's pretty talented. She's also a co-founder of the Me Too movement. And she's running interference for Joe Biden. She writes, "My name is Alyssa Milano. I don't have equal rights under the law. Why? Because I'm a woman, and there's no constitutional amendment guaranteed to protect me." So she's supporting Joe Biden because when he was in the Senate and he left 11 years ago, all right, he reintroduced the Equal Rights Amendment. Now, it was active in the 1970s, and it didn't pass. I supported it wholeheartedly then, and I even debated Phyllis Schlafly, the right-wing nut who was the lead opponent of the ERA. But to now give credit to Joe Biden for the Equal Rights Amendment, and just to be fair, it's been reintroduced just this past week in the House of Representatives. But it's a constitutional amendment that takes a long, arduous process to achieve. And we are nowhere near that. But Alyssa Milano is fronting a misleading email, raising money for Joe Biden, and trying to inoculate people against Anita Hill and the other missteps that Joe Biden has made related to women. And then there is the Ukraine scandal. And the New York Times publishes a lengthy piece today about Joe Biden, Ukraine, how I told you this earlier this week. He was there in 2016, and he threatened to hold back $1 billion in U.S. loan guarantees if Ukraine's leaders didn't fire the top prosecutor who was then investigating Burisma Holdings, where Joe Biden's boy, Hunter, had a perch that paid $50,000 a month. He was on the board of directors of the corporation. Hunter Biden says he never talked to Daddy about that, either before he went on the board or after. But if you read the Times story, and I've linked to it in the show file for this podcast, you will see that this is a real stinker. And at minimum, Joe Biden has some explaining to do. Now, Hunter quit the board at Burisma last month, just in time for Daddy to announce he's running for president. And the Times spins this as something that's being promoted by Trump and his allies. But that's not all. There are plenty of progressive Democrats who say, wait a minute, Joe Biden is tainted by the U.S.-backed coup against Yanukovych in Ukraine and then the profiteering by his son Hunter. This is not an attack. That's the way Biden supporters will depict it. It's an honest critique of Joe Biden's record. Two more items today. The Pentagon is reporting a 38% increase in sexual assaults by reported by service members in 2018. 20,500 instances of unwanted sexual conduct. And that's an increase from just under 15,000 in 2016 and about the same as the reported number from 2014. And this is one of the reasons why I have some support for Kirsten Gillibrand in her campaign for president. In the Senate, she's been the strongest voice calling for sexual crime investigations to be conducted outside the chain of command. And so far, she has not prevailed. And finally today, Stephen Taupert, a man who called Maxine Waters' office in Los Angeles and in a racist rant threatened to kill her. He also announced at a senator's office in Washington over the phone that he was planning to kill Barack Obama. Well, he was just sentenced to 46 months in prison after a trial in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the dang place. You'll find it on YouTube. And I'm still Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.